Native Americans are treated with much greater emphasis and sympathy, for sure. And that it's no longer called Custer's Massacre, the Massacre of Custer. It is the Battle of Little Bighorn. And Custer clearly comes off as the unsympathetic character. I think if you talk to most kids these days, there's a great deal of empathy. Empathy is too strong. Sympathy or admiration for Native American peoples, which probably didn't exist in most of our history. Well, I don't know, I shouldn't say that. Even in the Native American army, when you read the writings of like Sherman or some of his, even some of the worst practitioners like Sheridan, he has a great admiration and senses like this, the inevitability of the crushing of the Indians in the West.
Yes.
But there's that reform element that I think is important to recognize. But that's not your point.
But I can respond to it in maybe what might be a useful way to at least highlight what I'm trying to get at. I've often said that the difference between a conservative and a liberal in the United States is that the conservatives think the system works and they want to leave it alone. And the liberals say, well, we think the system can work, but we see some problems, some areas where the system doesn't work for some people, and we want to fix the system. And that's the reform element that has been a part of American life from the beginning. What I want to say is that there's not a whole lot of difference after all between a conservative and a liberal. That ultimately, what's at stake is a system of violence and oppression that can't be fixed by adjusting policies. I can give you a really important example. At no time did the Osage Nation ever ceded sovereignty to something called the United States of America and agree formally to be a part of the United States. Yet, slowly and inevitably, through the creation of legal fictions, the United States has assumed, presumed, and imposed its sovereignty on the Osage Nation and every other Indian community in the United States. We didn't ask for it. Some of us, even to this day, don't want it. And yet, it's there. It starts with it formally starts, in terms of American legal codex, with a decision in the Supreme Court, a decision written by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall, two of them actually, in 1829 and 1831. The Cherokee decision in 29 was a non-decision where the court decided they couldn't deal with the Cherokees because they were not a part of the United States. But he created this legal fiction in there that called in Cherokees and ultimately by extension all Indian peoples a domestic dependent nation. And he talked about Indian sovereignty as quasi-sovereignty. Well, the problem is that little piece of legal fiction now is used by every court in the United States to determine the relationship between Indian people and the United States. Well, the Indian people didn't decide that we were only quasi-sovereign. We didn't decide that we were wards of the state. We didn't decide that we were only domestic dependent nations and not real nations after all. You heard it most clearly on the lips of a congressman not too long ago, a very liberal congressman, Morris Udall, who was a friend of the Indians after all, as his brother Stuart was when he was Interior Secretary under the Kennedy administration. But only about 10 years ago, Mo Udall said, Indians aren't really sovereign, they're more like states. Well, how did he decide, how is it he got to decide that, or the United States got to decide that, and we Indian people don't have any say in that whatsoever? Well, liberal or conservative, as much as we try and tamper with the mechanisms and fix policies, nobody, liberal or conservative in white America, is willing to say, wait a minute, we've done something wrong here. That was unjust and immoral. We need to give Indian people their sovereignty back. You know why y'all won't do it? We have a legal claim, a legal claim in your laws to 30% of the North American landmass. And if you cede our sovereignty, we're going to come back and ask that 30% of the landmass back. You know, some of it's in downtown Kansas City. Pretty high-priced pieces of property these days.
Isn't this something very similar to what you're talking about happened in New York? It was like one of the very first codexes that happened was in Montauk. And there was, that was sort of like, I'm thinking like the Washington, D.C. of the Indian nations, at least on the east of the Iroquois.
Of the Iroquois.
Right.
And Confederacy.
Right. And Thomas Jefferson had a real interest in what was going on and trying to protect what was happening. But it was like the machine was already starting to move. It was like a juggernaut. And that these, the different chiefs, and I guess I don't know how to really phrase it very well. It's just something that I've heard, and I was, maybe you could enlighten me a little bit. But that there were several chiefs that were there. It was like the chief of all of the general nations in that whole northeastern quadrant of the country were focused at Montauk. Montauk's a Long Island extends out in toward the Atlantic, and at the end of Montauk, that's where all of this power was sort of kept. And that they basically said, the Montauk Indians do not exist. And they basically kind of intermarried them out of existence, but there still were some Montauk Indians, as they called them. That was their tribal name, but you don't hear much about them anymore.
Well, the Shinnecocks are still there. There's still a small reservation out in the, what do they call it, the Hampsteads? Or?
The Hamptons.
The Hamptons.
Right, South
They have a few square miles out there across from the DuPont Mansion.
Right.
the DuPont Summer Cottage.
So they're still on the land?
Yeah, yeah, and still holding on to their reservation, even though it's getting harder and harder to hold on to it because
it's
not much bigger. They're being offered more and more money for it. Let me give you another example. And if I get animated, I get animated. So don't let me intimidate you. Y'all come back at me just as animated. Senator Bill Bradley presented a bill to the Senate 10 years ago to return the Black Hills to the Sioux Nation. The Black Hills were quite frankly stolen from the Sioux. Custer created a war with the Sioux after gold was discovered in the Black Hills so that the U.S. could violate the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. In my book, and by the way, I still have copies if people want to buy it, and Holden is allowing me to sell it. And right at 5 o'clock, I'll bring them in here. In my book, I describe how Bishop Whipple, the first Episcopal bishop of Minnesota, colluded with the U.S. government and joined a U.S. government peace commission to go out among the Dakota and Lakota, the Sioux peoples, and to get as many of their leaders as possible to sign off on this theft of the Black Hills. And of course, all the so-called hostiles who were not there, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, all the others, who had just done, this is 1876, the summer after the Custer fiasco, so that you have a lot of the Sioux Nation, the majority of the Sioux Nation, at war with the United States. Whipple engineered these signed documents that enabled the United States to say, again, a piece of legal fiction, call it a legal lie, that they own the Black Hills. Well, the Sioux have turned down increasingly large sums of money in return for their claim on the Black Hills. The total is now $300 million being held in escrow for them by the government. And the government, out of those funds, has paid a white lawyer by the name of Bill Lazarus several million dollars to represent the Sioux. And the Sioux have said consistently, he doesn't represent us. So one thinks it's a little bit like welfare, you know. Welfare isn't really intended to help the poor. It's just another way of circulating money in the white economy. I mean, that's my cynicism. I'm sorry, but I came through the Vietnam years. Let me finish it. But Bradley presented this bill. Bradley wanted, in fact, to give the Black Hills back to the Sioux. It never got out of committee because what Bradley was doing was something that the system cannot deal with. Because if you give the Black Hills back to the Sioux, I mean, they're being offered $300 million, but Homestake Mining Corporation has taken $4 billion worth of gold out of the Black Hills. That's not much of a trade. Other tribes are going to be coming around saying, yeah, we've got claims too. So, you know, you can't even begin to make the past injustices right without ending up destroying the economy of the United States.
Wouldn't you have to, if you carry this, start it in reverse, to do this process if Bradley was successful, and that took hold, and you went into reverse, wouldn't you have to keep going in reverse, cross back the ocean, go back to Europe, and go back in reverse there? I mean, where in history has this, over time, the same things have happened for thousands and thousands and thousands of years? So, you're extinct. Whatever's left is left. I mean, so I'm having trouble. I'm trying to say, well, we're trying to come to some sort of answer here. Yeah. And yet, how far do you go to right an injustice? To do it properly, you have to wipe the slate clean.
Well, what does Jesus say about it? I mean, we're Christians, right? Mm-hmm. What does Jesus say about it?
Sell all you have.
That's one saying. But if another saying is...
We don't covet the land. We don't really own the land. No one does.
What does Jesus say on this?
Well, if we're going to be in some sort of harmony with the gospel, then we've got to think in terms of justice and injustices in those terms. We've got to think in terms of making right wrongs. I mean, where is it in Leviticus that, you know, the rules for giving people back what you've stolen are, you know, to add a fifth to it. So you give it back and add a fifth to it. You know, in the gospel, you know, you've got paradigms for that kind of stuff. In, for instance, tax collector who comes to Jesus and is converted by Jesus and is giving back everything that he stole. I don't know that there's any other solution to an example of theft other than giving stuff back to people.
How do we do that?
If I have, let's say. Tim over there has stolen your watch. Okay?
Yeah,
all right. Now, he sold it to me for a nice little profit for him and a good deal for me, and I've got a new watch. A pretty good one that I got for a steal, so to speak. How long do I have to have this watch before you can no longer contest its theft? See, being a recipient of stolen property does not leave me off the hook in American jurisprudence. I'm still culpable. I can not only have to give you the watch back, but I'll go to jail, possibly, for being a recipient of stolen property. But let's say, how long before you can no longer contest it? 2 weeks? 2 years? For murder, there's no statute of limitation at all. I mean, there is a statute of limitation on simple theft.
After World War II, they're still trying to sort out what artwork belongs to what country.
That's right.
And yeah. They're still returning it.
That's right.
They're still trying to say, well, this was stolen from this museum. This was stolen from this house. They're still tracing it back.
Go ahead.
Well, the Black Hills are a problematic issue, too, because they were once the sacred place of the Crow, and then the Sioux moved in, being forced westward. How does that work itself out?
No, evidently those places were always held by all peoples as sacred.
But if the Sioux...
In other words, the Sioux, I'm going to argue the Sioux were not pushed westward.
Okay, they might.
I think that's a part of another one, and that's not a legal fiction. That's what we call academic fiction, yeah.
Well, so they were, that was their homeland.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That is the heart of the earth for them in their mythology. And they're beginning to demonstrate through something called ethnoastronomy that they actually inhabited that territory for thousands of years.
And the Crow don't have a competing claim on it? As I
Absolutely.
Heard?
I mean, the heart of the earth belongs to everyone out there. So, but the Crow are not contesting the Black Hills. The Lakota are. I mean, just to the east of the Black Hills is Bear Butte. Bear Butte was a place where Crows, Cheyennes, Sioux, Hidatsus, Mandans, Crees, at one point Kickapoos, and Kiowas could count on camping and not being attacked by an enemy.
Because it's sacred.
Because it's sacred to all of those people. Adam had a question, then Zarco, and then over here.
Well, what does giving it back mean for the several hundred million of us who aren't Native American?
Mm-hmm. In other words, does the majority rule on this one? Can the majority decide that the minority suffers?
No.
I'm saying that. I'm carrying it out as a cynical, logical conclusion.
What does that mean? Do we move? No,
I think that's an important question. The Sioux are not asking for all the land back that was taken from them in that gambit that Bishop Whipple was a part of. In fact, they lost most of South Dakota, Wyoming, northern Nebraska, west of the Missouri River. And a lot of that is owned by individuals. And they ought to be able to rightfully ask for all those Lutheran farms back, right? But they're not. They're only asking for those lands that are public lands. The national forest, state forest, national monument portions of the Black Hills.
I didn't make it so reasonable. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problems with
that. I want to respond to a couple of things. There's so many issues here that keep me going here. One issue is, I think Native Americans would love to believe that European Americans would at least admit that in the name of the gospel there was some great injustice committed in this country, that in this continent, and that this has not even been admitted in our schools, in our churches. And we would like to think that someday our territories would be given back, our burial grounds, not only the place of worship, but the burial grounds. That is a task that we'll never see happen. Mm-hmm. One thing that people can do, especially people like the people here at Holland who are conscientious people or educated people who are activists in their communities and their churches, is to stop the same historical process that happened in this country, the same injustice that is being perpetuated daily in other places other than our own backyards. Mm-hmm. In Central America, in Mexico, in South America, in the Amazon, in other parts of the world, the same historical process is continuing and is still receiving support inadvertently from us as taxpayers, from our church groups, and the process continues to go on. So if you're having a hard time dealing with all of these truths about history that are coming out, and you're trying to reconcile these things, the only way to go about doing it is to become an activist in your community for these native peoples, these native groups, and to help support their causes. In Chiapas, in Mexico, it's happening right now. And I'm not asking you to go down there and fight for the Indian people of Chiapas, who are experiencing right now what happened here 500 years ago.
I see.
200 years ago. It happened there 500 years ago and continues to happen. And so you're not going to have to go down to fight, but somehow in your life, in your daily life, in your program of your life, you have to divert or contribute something of your time, your energy, and your resources to those people. I mean, that to me is being a Christian. You know, fine, okay, we admit it, it's gone, it's over with, but it continues to happen.
Zarco, I guess I would, as a teacher, I think in my classroom, I make it abundantly clear, and the kids in their responses to me when we deal with that aspect of our history, there is a great deal of shame or recognition that this was a crime. And so I would say that process is beginning and there is admission. And I would certainly think that among that is occurring.
Well, that's a great idea. As a teacher, for example, there's teachers that do things like they raise money to help purchase land in the rainforest to keep that land away from developers and prospectors and things like that. That is a process that works.
I think we have to get beyond white guilt.
Well,
we have to move to an activist approach. I don't think we can be in solidarity by just going those poor people. I mean, I really think we have to find a way, some kind of an activist way to be in solidarity.
I don't work with guilt so much as this is what has happened. And
that's right, the wrong.
Right.
See, one problem with guilt, and in my classes at Iowa School of Theology, I usually contract with a large class or even a small seminar that they'll struggle valiantly to avoid feelings of guilt. Guilt isn't helpful because guilt generates usually a defensive response that is destructive. So I guess I want to really strongly affirm this notion that somehow we've got to avoid feeling guilty for all of this, but rather do what Zarco's insisting we do, just to face the music. I mean, to say, this was immoral and unjust, and we did it.
How can we address the issue of violence in this country if we don't admit that the very building of this country was built on violence and injustice? How can we ever stop the violence that's happening around us? But there was one comment made that I know it was made inadvertently that slavery was over. For people in the inner city,
it's a slavery of that form.
Of that form, you said of that form. That's true. Of that form, but it just took another form, and there's still slavery in this country. There's still
so that ending of slavery is not anything significant then for you.
Yeah, I mean, for some way, it's not. It's not. When you
see, it was just a transformation, I think. I think our people now are in bondage for the economic, and for my children are in bondage of TV and the violence that's in TV. When I came to the seminar today, I was just going to comment that we can spend the whole day talking about history, try to revise history. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, I don't think the United States or any superpower in this continent will ever say, I'm sorry to the Indian peoples and give back anything. That's impossible. Now what we can do is, what has that generated? I see the violence that our children live with being rooted in the conflict of culture that took place and is still taking place after 500 years. What
the violence of greed. So
the violence of greed, I think that's what I think. Well,
I think we have to name the myth of redemptive violence, or whatever you want to call it, and deal with that, because I think that's a part of why this continues to happen. I mean, the country's built on redemptive violence.
I think that's right. What both Carmen and Judith are saying, but I think there's more to it, and I want to press to that more. Because, and Carmen was getting at it, what happened, no, it was Zarco who said this, what happened here 200 years ago is happening still in the jungles of Brazil, in Chiapas, in Ecuador. If I can give you one example, in Ecuador, the headwaters of the Amazon comprise a jungle region called Oriente. The Oriente has been impenetrable to European immigrants in Ecuador. The state of Ecuador has claimed that territory as their own, even though it was impenetrable to them and unusable. But as technology has advanced, now we have the ability to clear-cut jungles and make them useful for a while. So we're clear-cutting the rainforest in Brazil, in Venezuela, in other countries, in order to plant grain to raise beef to feed North America's McDonald's habit. Now we're involved then, implicitly, in the clear-cutting of rainforest, whether we want to be or not, and I as an individual, you as an individual, cannot stop it. Because the systemic institutionalized form of eco-violence is a machine that is unstoppable. It's unstoppable without stopping something intrinsically evil about capitalism, about modern technology, about the need for the wealthy to continue to generate ever greater economic surpluses. I just read that there's a new high in billionaires in the world. There's something like a dozen billionaires now in the world, most of them Americans, not all of them by any means. But now, In the Oriente, where Ecuadorians have finally figured out how to enter the jungle, there's a people that have lived in the Oriente as their own for thousands of years, the Huarani. The Huarani know nothing of Ecuador, just as Ecuador has known nothing of the Huarani until now. But they've been able to destroy the Huarani's habitat by moving in with heavy equipment and clear-cutting 100-yard swaths through the jungle, all the way through the Oriente, the entire length of it, every mile, so that they can move in equipment. And there's a lot of oil there. There is so much oil in the Oriente that we're told that it could supply the United States energy needs for 300 days. For 300 days worth of oil in the north, we're destroying a people. Their culture's gone, You know, oil spills all along those trails have now invaded the headwaters of the Amazon, so that you know, the fish portion of their diet is no longer edible. In fact, fish are being killed in the headwaters of the Oriente. Why would Ecuador do that? Well, unfortunately, the answer involves us again. They do that primarily not to make Ecuador a richer country, but to pay the interest on their international debt to New York banks. So that, you know, systemically now, we're involved again in the destruction of a people. And now, that's the kind of violence I'd like for us to get at systemically and talk about what is it about this system that we have generated, this world system that insists on blood sacrifice, insists on consuming whole peoples, insists on impoverishing so much of the world in order for us to have a richer lifestyle, a more comfortable lifestyle. I can't think of a better place than Holden, where a bunch of people are committed to a lower rate of consumption, to ask this question and to ask, how can we not make a difference in my life and in your life, but how can we make a difference now in the systemic life that has that has consumed not only the United States, but most of the world? I'm asking you. My job is to raise the question.
That's the easy part. Anybody can raise a question. Now, let's have some wisdom and some suggestions. We don't have to necessarily take them, but put something on the table.
Well, it's not true that anybody can raise a question here. I mean, that anybody can raise a question is suggesting that there's no thoughtfulness to it, there's no experience with it, there's no connection and perspective on the whole view of it all. Not anybody can raise the question.
It's kind of getting back to what I think you said a little earlier about how you can have a group of people who all want to do something and all decide not to do something because they think everyone else, because that's what they've always done. And I've talked with a lot of people who don't like the fact that they drive cars that pollute, or the fact that we took the land from Native Americans in the past. I mean, for me, the vast majority of the people, basically everyone where I live, doesn't like that. But almost nothing is being done because it's so huge. 250 million people is a lot of people. And it's hard to change within that system. It's not impossible. Needs to be done. That to me is the biggest challenge. Not even changing people's minds about what they think about it, but finding some way to change within a system that is doing things that they don't want to do.
The question is, how can we make systemic change? Now, to illustrate something Adam was saying, I want to pick something that's not a systemic change. In my mind, gun control is a tune-up,
a liberal policy
tune-up matter. But look at the trouble we're having just with getting something that seems to be a no-brainer like gun control. The vast majority of American citizens are in favor of it, yet the Congress refuses to act. This young woman here, did she have a comment? Judith, is this your daughter? Did you have your hand up?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't want to leave you out if you did have a comment. Susan.
Well, I regret this very much, but I don't know very much about economics, especially world economics. And the more that I'm discovering about the way our country works, the more I wish that I had majored in economics, majored in music, you know.
Every musician should understand the economic world system.
But it bothers me increasingly that we, as a barometer of our country's health, we measure the growth, economic growth of the country to judge its health. And it seems to me that the primary things that we should be using as indicators of our country's health would be infant mortality rate, a number percentage of people under poverty level,
literacy.
Things like that should be the indicators of whether the country is healthy and not whether we're growing economically.
If y'all want to take a look at my book, I'll just circulate a couple of them.
So I took a class on racism. It's interesting. There's different different minority group perspectives, and the one on the Native American perspective, they were saying that there's a debate on the Black Hills about the Native American community, if it should be sold. I mean, they should take the money for it or not. And he was saying that his tribe, he disagreed with his tribe, but that they were saying to take the money for it.
It's tempting just to take the money when you think you might never get the Black Hills back. But let me suggest something now in the few closing minutes that we have that may be systemic, because I really want to make a systemic change. I'm not interested in just fixing policy. I think the system is such that we'll even have trouble changing policy when big money and power get behind something like the right to bear arms. I mean, that may have made sense 200 years ago, but boy, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in Denver today. You know, there's no threat of foreign invasion, and that had to do with threat of foreign invasion, the right to bear arms to defend oneself against an invader, not to shoot some 13-year-old kid who's breaking into my tool shed. Or in Denver, we have a law that didn't last very long, but it was on the books for a while, the Make My Neighbor's Day law, where you can shoot somebody if you think they're breaking into your neighbor's stuff. Yeah, it's a wonderful world.
Well, getting back to the
let me continue, because I need to now, with time running down, to press towards making something, getting us somewhere moved towards understanding what is systemic and what isn't. I happen to believe that the one thing people could do in the United States today that would be systemic would be to support the Sioux Nation's claim on the Black Hills and to work at a grassroots level towards building people's understanding of the situation so that there's grassroots support across the nation for returning the Black Hills to the Sioux Nation. I think that is not merely a policy shift, because what it would do would be, to go back to a comment I made earlier, would be to shift the United States into a mode of actually paying attention to past injustices and making them right in ways that are going to be very, very leveling in terms of relationships between Indians and whites. It will not only affect the United States, but eventually that act begins to affect the entire world economy. Because you see, the situation with regard to American Indians on this continent is not very different, after all, from the situation of indigenous peoples in every colonized community. The Aboriginals in Australia are dealing with the same issues. The Maoris in New Zealand, Indians in South America, the Nagas. Do you all realize that there has been a war waging in India for 50 years between India and that territory called Nagaland, which is in part in territory claimed by India? You never read about it in the U.S. press, but there's been a live open warfare between the Nagas and the Indian government since Indian independence back in the 40s. Nagaland has been summarily sliced into two groups by the India-Burmese border, so that some 1 million Nagas live in Burma and some 2 million live in India. Neither are happy being a part of either government and want to be simply themselves. If you ask what Indian people want, what we want is our peopleness back. We want to be a people again and not, you know, a part of some working class or class of poor. See, that's why Marxism never would work for Indian people, because the Marxian vision was to reduce everyone to a cultureless class society, where, you know, Indian people, instead of being Osages and Navajos, are part of the workers. See, and that would never work for Indian people. We want our peopleness back. The Nagas want their peopleness back. The Aboriginals want their peopleness back. The Maoris in New Zealand simply want their peopleness back and enough land to support their peopleness. And they, like American Indians, have enormous claims on New Zealand's territory, portions of New Zealand's territory that were taken apart from treaty negotiations. Returning the Black Hills to the Sioux begins a process that would be world-changing. It would force international dialogue to deal with indigenous peoples in ways that international discourse till now has failed. Even human rights discourse, catch this, human rights summit in Vienna three summers ago, 92, insisted that human rights are rights attached to individuals and not to groups. You know what that is? That's a slap at Indians and all indigenous peoples in the world. What it says is, as a group of people, we have no human rights. That human rights only adhere on an individual basis. Good Western thinking, European thinking. Well, at some point, we've got to come to grips with the fact that peoples also have rights over against one another. And when a modern so-called state abuses a whole people within its borders, a whole tribe or nation of people within its borders, that there are human rights abuses involved there that involve the genocide of a culture, not just the killing of individuals, but the killing of a whole people, or the destruction of their culture and their way of life, the destruction of the values that they bring into the world and offer to the world community. What I've been saying for 2 days is that Indian peoples on this continent, and I would stretch it, expand it to include all indigenous peoples, have values, cultural values, that are important not just to us, but are important to the whole world community. That in fact, a monocultural world is not going to be a healthy world any more than it was healthy for the Irish to plant one variety of Peruvian potato and hope that they could survive on one variety of potato, which they did quite well until the blight came. And they had no potatoes resistant to the blight. All of them were russets and quite rotten in the field. So if we're going to make that kind of systemic change, we've got to figure out strategies that really are systemic, that really do impact the whole. And I suspect that giving the Black Hills back to the Sioux Nation is the beginning of a process that would change international discourse and change the way not only the United States does business, but every state in the world. And then Tim.
I agree with what you're saying, and I think also there was some talk about being an advocate or assertive, or rather than feeling guilty, doing something about it. I think that's also important. I was reading.
Yeah, this is doable, folks. We can do this.
I was reading something from Martin Luther King, and it was about the Birmingham jail. He's talking about. A letter that he was writing in Birmingham jail, and he was saying that people in power never want to give up their power. So I think that's another reason we got to use activism.
Yep. Tim, and then this woman in the front, whose name I don't know.
Curious, what would that look like if we gave the Black Hills back to this? What would they do with it? What changes would they make?
That would be up to the Sioux, ultimately, because it would become their sovereign territory. And if they wanted to blow the faces off of Mount Rushmore, that would be their decision, their choice. And if they wanted to continue to run it as a money-making tourist attraction, well, I suppose they could do that too. I think, given the realities, let me press it, because it's a useful question, an important one. Given the reality of Sioux poverty today, that it's not going to be enough to give the Black Hills back, but the U.S. government's going to have to budget caretaking monies for the Sioux to take care of the Black Hills, so that monies that are currently being spent to manage the forests and to manage the National Monument would accrue to the Sioux Nation to also manage the Black Hills, however they're going to manage it.
Visualizing this next step, I question whether it could be done nonviolently in this nation or in other nations around the world. It would be a drastic change, and I'm suggesting that it would start wars all over the world.
And
it would start here first.
But the wars are all...
I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that we're talking nonviolence, but I think that with the militia that has had the awareness of militia in this country that has been brought out in awareness lately, there's no doubt that whether it's the federal government or the militias, there would be a violence.
But we can't let that intimidate us into non-action, on the one hand. On the other hand, the world is so full of violence now, there are wars all over the world being fought over precisely these issues, and wars that are really ultimately of, let me say, our making, and by that, let me say, not just America's making, but the making of colonial Europe. Let me give you one quick example. In Rwanda, and now in Burundi, we've got two peoples who have been pitted against one another, the Hutus and the Tutsis, who, until colonialism, always lived in peace and harmony with one another. But now they've been parked in these artificial constructs called states. See, we assume that this is the only way to do national business anymore, is to have a state. But these states are artificial. The Tutsis and the Hutus didn't determine those boundaries, but the French did, because they were the colonizer in Rwanda. And they've thrown these two tribes in now to fight it out politically. It's like Democrats and Republicans, only being Democrat or Republican depends upon your bloodline. not upon your philosophical position. And that's even harder to deal with, because people don't change from being Tutsi to Hutu overnight, the way Ben Campbell changed from Democrat to Republican. So these are suddenly life and death issues, and control of the state, whereas before, each nation, the Hutu nation and the Tutsi nation, took care of themselves. Now, control of the state and the destiny of both nations is determined by who gets control of the political process. So that, you know, this is a miserable problem, and there are going to be more and more of these kinds of ethnocentric wars. Whereas, if we can give the Tutus their nation, the Tutsis, and the Hutus their nation, then they don't need to fight one another for political control. I mean, and this is symptomatic of all of Africa. There is no modern state in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, that has not been determined by colonial powers and given an artificial set of boundaries in Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya. The Meru are divided into three states, and they're one nation, one people under God. Well, not anymore. They're three separate states, and they don't have enough to be in control in any of the three states.
Do you think a multinational state is unworkable then?
It's unworkable in its modern configuration, yes. I think that's true. I think it imposes poverty on all of Africa, because you're going to have factions fighting, and then you've got not only the World Bank and International Monetary Fund that you're coming up against, but internal turmoil means that these states will never be settled completely.
I thought I heard something several years ago about a program to give Northwest Territories back to the Inuit, I think. You know what happened with that? I didn't ever hear anything again.
I was going to ask you that about, is Canada moving in that direction?
I'm not up to snuff on what's going on in Canada. I know as much as you all do. And I don't want to say anything about it, because I'm simply not up to snuff on it. I know that Indians in Canada wrestle with Canadian government as much as Indians down here do. If you followed the incident at Oka about 5 years ago on the Canadian side of the Mohawk Reservation, you'll know that things are not settled there. The Canadians are not any more sanguine than the U.S. government about how to deal with Native peoples. But there is a lot of talk. I mean, people in the Yukon, Indians in the Yukon, are not just the Inuits, but the Neb peoples especially, are very much activists, and they have members in provincial parliaments. In fact, we had a woman for a conference in Denver a few months ago who is a former member of the provincial parliament in the Yukon. So they're talking, yes, but I don't know what the state of those talks are at this point. Well, at least we're thinking about things. And if all we've done is raise the question, if the question hasn't been raised this way before, we never would have had, you know, it suggests different answers. If I've got you all thinking about different questions, then there's going to be some different answers down the line. Are we at time?
About 5 minutes.
I'll repeat the announcement I made yesterday. I think not everyone was here. These books help support Living Waters Indian Ministry, a ministry of the ELCA, Rocky Mountain Synod. In Denver, Colorado, the proceeds from them. If anybody would like one, they're $11. Closing comment? Lee.
When you made your comment before about the World Conference on
Human Rights, in Vienna,
and the statement about the individual being the focus, the thought just went through my head that this was almost like, individualism is a very intoxicating type of experience. And it's almost like a drug dependency in some respects. Mm-hmm. And one could think of this as a conspiracy of the system to keep the individual hooked and in effect take away the power of the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are times when I've also talked about the state exercise of power as addiction. And I think that to a certain extent, the U.S. exercise of power is a primary example of state, addictions, dysfunctionality, the need to be in control. I mean, and it's not new. I mean, the Monroe Doctrine was an obscenity from the beginning. Why would we think we had a right to determine political decisions south of our borders in the Western Hemisphere? Isn't that a curious one? Hear less about the Monroe Doctrine these days.
Just about Panama.
Yes, right, right.
It's still
right.
I think another one you can add to Euro-American is after guilt is justification. We justify whatever we do, Vietnam and Panama and Saudi Arabia. There's always a good reason to do it.
Especially with this giant resurgence of suing people for everything. You know, it's not my fault I tripped and broke my leg. It's your fault for having it there on the road. Or, you know, it's absolutely mind-boggling the amount of things people sue for.
Yeah.
Do you see the United States giving back to Panama, the Panama Canal, and the British giving back to China, Hong Kong, in the same light as giving back the Black Hills? Is that the kind of systemic change? Are there any comparisons there?
No, because not in the same ballpark. Because giving the Panama Canal back to Panama is releasing Panamanian territory to Panama. And Panama's a recognized state, so we haven't really rocked the boat by doing that. After all, we continue to see Panama as a state in the drama of states on the stage of the United Nations. So that, and the same is true in the negotiation over Hong Kong between the UK and China. What's different about giving the Black Hills back to the Sioux is the recognition of Aboriginal rights of an Aboriginal indigenous people who have, at this date, no standing whatsoever in international law. I mean, it's emerging, maybe the UN has a working group on indigenous peoples discussing these issues. Has been now for 15 years. But the US has fought it every step of the way. The U.S. wanted to call it the Working Group on Indigenous Populations. They were willing to compromise and call it...